All right, so I thought I would offer one more talk on boundaries. And I apologize, I wasn't able to listen to Sousa's talk from last week, so hopefully this doesn't overlap too much. But if it does, hopefully it's complementary. So as we walk this spiritual practice, this path, and all the various ways that it takes for each person, there's this paradox we find between this release of our sense of separation, this release of our sense of contraction of heart. In some ways, it's a release of our that sense of boundaries. We become less defined, at the same time, less separate. We become more interconnected. And the paradox then is we bump up against other people, our relationships, the ones dear to us, the ones we struggle with, and we find that our interpersonal boundaries often aren't so intact or so clear or so healthy. And when we're perhaps deep in practice and we feel this sense of peace, a sense of ease, and then we talk to another person and all that goes out the window, where's that balance? Where's that the path? And these paradoxes, I think, are very helpful things to explore as practitioners, the things that seem to be outside of our practice. And so, as I spoke about a couple of weeks ago, the importance of having healthy boundaries, to have boundaries which are a way of honoring your integrity and another person's integrity. Because if we overlook that, even if we have very deep insights and understanding and wisdom and compassion starts to grow and more clearly in our hearts, if we have some unresolved issues around our boundaries, particularly around, low self-worth, trauma, abuse, codependence, so many different ways enmeshment these things show up, that will also show up in our practice and in our relationships. And so learning to find that mix, that balance of healthy boundaries, but at the same time learning how to release that sense of separation. And that's what I want to explore more tonight, is that releasing of the separation. Because with this paradox, boundaries are a way of in some ways saying no, of drawing limits, placing limits. And in that way, it enhances and even maintains this sense of separation. Like, no, this is not okay with me, or I'm kind of holding myself in so I don't cause harm. My spirituality often has this attitude of saying yes, of releasing limits, even questions separation and sees how to release that. So how do we explore this quality of paradox? When are boundaries something that's helpful and needed? And when do they keep us more imprisoned and locked in that quality of separation? Often, I think boundaries as a baseline are around when we have the potential for causing harm in all its myriad ways, subtle ways, more overt ways. This is the precepts help to support us in this. Also, when we are causing or experiencing harm ourselves, how do we do that, both causing harm outwardly and receiving harm? That's often where boundaries need to come in and need to be enhanced, especially when we feel it's difficult to draw those. This includes all the subtle boundaries of overwork, of overcommitment, of saying yes too much. Now, as I'm reflecting on this, we can have a set of boundaries, we can establish boundaries, and have a lot of separation really built into that. There's the premise from which I'm drawing that boundary or placing that boundary, there can be a lot of sense of me and the other person. I'm protecting myself from you, or I'm protecting you from myself. It really does establish and maintain that sense of separation. And often we need to learn this, we need to understand this, especially when we were taught or learned boundaries very differently as children or through our experiences. And often in this sense of asserting our boundaries, when we have this kind of inner doubt whether we really deserve to have those boundaries, when we have this inner questioning around them, then our boundaries tend to be very solid, you know, very rigid, very kind of hard, even a little bit hostile, because there's this inner weakness that we have to overcompensate with our show of strength. There's often a lot of charge when we draw boundaries. You know, not to judge this. This is just, we often, especially when we haven't really established boundaries, we have to almost bring that energy to it. But when we understand and know our wholeness, when we know our sense of integrity and also someone else's wholeness and their integrity, the boundaries tend to be a quality of being much more clear without rigidity. There's an inner strength, an inner alignment that allows us to be very responsive to how those boundaries are expressed and drawn. You know, it's just a matter of fact where there's not a lot of charge with it. This is a boundary that is drawn without a lot of inner separation. So it seems like that's, again, a paradox, that I can have a boundary without the sense of me and the other. And just a matter of fact, like, this is a way to care for ourselves, to care for myself. Well, if I don't have that, then often it is really much me and you. Like, don't tread on me, don't cause me harm, or I need to hold myself back so I'm not causing you harm. There's a lot of that separation inherent. So how we learn to kind of navigate and grow, even evolve from this first kind of boundary where there's that separation and there's really that rigidity versus that quality of that inner strength, that inner alignment and conviction of your own wholeness. You know, what's that trajectory look like? Sometimes it might happen right in the beginning of practice, sometimes in the middle of practice, sometimes after we've had deeper insights, deeper understanding, and we realize, okay, I have to learn to integrate my life, integrate my relationships, integrate all those things I've left outside of my practice. And life's going to always teach you that, offer those lessons to help you clean this up. And so I'd like to explore a little bit some of the examples of how this release of separation, going into now the side of boundaries as a way that we kind of hold them on too long. They keep a quality of contraction. And also the movement of, let's say, non-separation in our practice. Because it's really not about not having boundaries, it's more about that quality of separation, of isolation, that our practice starts to show us more and more. So starting with the body, the sense of the body, is that poem I spoke of and also kind of hinted at in the meditation, that we sit down to start to practice, you know, with our body. That's the first instructions we get, and it's often a go-to place we rely on in our daily practice. And the body is such a helpful template for how to work with more complex things, like the mental states with emotions. Because it's really the same process. It's just the body has a certain grounding, a certain simplicity, a certain immediacy that we sometimes lose sight of when we look at something like a thought or emotion. So we start with practice. We start to meditate. And we start to notice the sense of the breath. We start to notice the sensations in the body. And this is often a very important shift from the idea of body, the thoughts about the body, to the actual felt experience of the body. Yeah, so what is, you know, what's the sense of the breath? Even the idea of breath is very different, as we all know, from that vast experience of the body breathing, the varying pressures, the varying sensations. It's much richer than the word breath, the idea of breath. And opening to the quality of a limb or a hand or just the torso in general, and feeling the various tingling, the various pressure, the warmth, and how nuanced it is, and how we start to really connect with that experience outside of our thought of it, becomes very rich and very constantly changing, constantly in flux. When we're doing this, we're not maintaining or adding to our idea of the body, of our body, and all that goes with it. All that starts to fade to the backdrop. By connecting with the sensations, we're not thinking about the body. And more importantly, we're starting to drop our habitual way of holding our body locked in our mind. You know, we all, you know, if you're not sure what I'm talking about, look at yourself in the mirror. And right there, boom, there's all the ideas of what your body is. All the parts that you admire about it, all the parts that you perhaps don't like about it, it comes right to the forefront. And it's so hard to separate those two things out, you know, the actual body versus the idea of the body. They become almost inseparable. You close your eyes and you're just going into the sensations of the body, letting go of those, the visual, the constant flow of those sensations, the rising and passing starts to, we're not maintaining, not adding to the idea of the body. That starts to fade. Now, so often we orient our body through the visual field. You know, I look at my hand and I see this scar here. I know where I got that, and this callus, and this joint that's a little swollen. And there's all these ideas that help me fix my hand, and I know what it is really solidly. You know, how is it compared to my other hand? How does my body compare to other people? How does it compare to society's ideal? You know, however that's defined. You know, there's so much internal and external judgment just floods in as we start to contemplate our body mentally. You know, you compare, I don't look as good as that person. I don't look as good as I did when I was 20, or whatever comes to mind around that, and how it's controlled by our culture, by our cultural norms, and how that changes over time. I remember doing this, going on one of those kind of living interpretation tours where the person was talking like in a Revolutionary War time accent. And she was saying how often many brides were surprised when they found half their husband was kind of in the corner of the room. Because in that time, you know, if you were kind of portly, that showed that you could provide for yourself. You actually had enough affluence to overeat. So men would actually add padding to their give themselves a pot belly to be more attractive. Right. And so it's an example that, you know, of course we have a very different idea these days, but just showing how culture tells you what's attractive and what's not. And we internalize that in such a deep way. It's so painful for so many of us as our bodies don't match up to what society says, what the images on the airbrushed magazines tell us. This is all the mental construct. This is all part of that prison that we've given to our own self. And the body is such a personal part of who we take ourselves to be, and our ideas and thoughts about it. You know, we can look at gender, we can look at race, we can look at so many different ways of how we define our body as good or not good. We also define our body through our minds, you know, through our relationship to, through pain, through discomfort, and through aging. And there are, of course, actual sensations of the pain. We often are more oriented in interpreting through our really the meaning we've attached to those sensations. So, you know, those of you in the room or online who have chronic pain, you know how the pain starts to take its own kind of momentum. When you wake up and you have that pain that you've had for the last number of years, the past really colors how the day you think the day will go. You're relating to the moment and the future based on your past history around it. One friend I have who struggled with chronic pain told me that a big changing point for him was when he learned to, in his words, divorce the pain from the fear, divorce the sensation from the fear of it. because the fear amplifies it. It brings this it makes the future reflect what the past was. And again, part of the power of how the mind takes a sensation and adds a meaning to it. The aging body, the loss of capacity and capabilities. You know, we're not able to do what we used to be able to do. You know, there's so many different levels of this old age, sickness and death. All of these have this way of fixing ourselves and our experience. It's a rigid kind of a boundary in a way that this is who I am. This is where I start and where I end. And it's really formed by thoughts. And there's a separation that's inherent in that as I'm looking at myself and judging that part of me. Judgment is inherently based in separation. Comparison is inherently based in separation. So then we take all that milieu, this gestalt that we sit around, always holding it, you know, this idea of bond, of body, the images, the judgments, the cultural conditioning. We sit down with our relationship to discomfort and to aging. And then you turn yourself to the sensations which are present. Right? The sense, and if you really do that sincerely, what happens to all the ideas around the body? Have you noticed how they kind of stop if you're not thinking about them, if you're not maintaining them? It's like you have a locomotive that you had to keep shoveling coal in. You stop shoveling coal, that locomotive starts to slow down. We're not adding to that. As you start to lose contact with those concepts and ideas, as what comes to the forefront is the actual sensations which are present. When this happens, we're losing contact with our body, with the sense, the idea of the body is what I mean. It's kind of a paradox, right? Because we're going deeply into the sensations of the body. We're becoming more embodied, but we're becoming less thought-driven, less concept-driven, less enmeshed with our ideas of the body. And when this first happens, sometimes it's a little disconcerting because you're like meditating and you're like suddenly, where is my body? My outline of my body is kind of faded or dissolved because we're so used to saying body and thought are one of the thing. We've combined those two in our experience because we're loosing the idea of body and going into the direct experience. So then as we relax into that, we start to find the freedom of that. Become that easing of that mental construct, that mental contraction of boundary. And we're just feeling the moment by moment wonder, really, of how the sensations are arising and passing away. You know, as the mind becomes more concentrated, is able to stay steady and just rest on this experience, it can be very rich, very, you know, amazing seems like a little bit of a cliche, but there's this wonder that's there. There's a freedom in that as we're loosening those mental constructs. It's much more rich of an experience in our thoughts. And then we start to do this interesting transition of learning how to orient to the sensations of our body and seeing that the thoughts are something I've added onto it versus the thing in itself. Usually we think of the thoughts as what we are instead of something added to. You see the difference? The added to. We start to realize I'm adding to something that's already inherently there. And we naturally, our hearts really love to connect with what's actually here. They actually like to connect with this immediacy of this experience. The immediacy of what's present. And then the idea of body. When we start to use that as when it's helpful, when it's actually useful to know, okay, this is my, you know, my left index finger, ring finger is where I put my wedding ring on, not my right one. I do this and that. I need to take care of this part of my body. I need to strengthen this left side, which is weaker than my right side. But it's just not, we're just using it, those thoughts, as a tool to help us learn to be more skillful. We're not so confused about what we really are. We realize our body is not our thoughts. Our body is much richer than any one thought. We start to see, in doing this mindfulness awareness, presence itself is what's observing the body. So, you know, we spent some time going through this idea of the body to show, in the, looking at it from the context of boundaries, how our thoughts or ideas make our kind of constrict a sense of container around us. This is really based in thought. As we go into the felt sense of the body, the actual experience, that container starts to dissolve. There's a release of that separation. This is part of the trajectory of our practice. Take the same process into thoughts and emotions. This is a big shift. We start to wake up to the fact that we are thinking so much of the time, and actually make this really fundamental shift from being lost in thought, being enmeshed in thought with no sense of perspective, to actually be able to observe the fact that I'm thinking, that a thought's arising. Because usually we're so enmeshed with those thoughts without any perspective, without any sense of observation. There's really a quality that I am those thoughts. I am those thoughts. That is what I am. This is who I am in this moment. As we start to step back and see that those thoughts are arising, we realize somehow I'm observing the thoughts. So I can't be completely in those thoughts. It's like the breath arises, you know, the breath moves through the body, but the body is not the breath, is it? It's how the mind thinks. The mind is not its thoughts. The mind is a different capacity, a different quality. So in reality, we have this idea that I'm thinking this thought or I am this thought. The thoughts, in a fundamental way, are really thinking us. A thought arises in a sense of who I am, what I am, relationship to thought rises at the same time. So we start to practice. We often notice this by, you know, grounding in the body, feeling the sensations, or opening to sound, if that's a better object. And we start to see how insistent our minds are and how random they are. I mean, how often have you been surprised by just, okay, I haven't thought about that for 20 years, and it's popped up suddenly. Or the mind goes this way or that way in a seemingly random, unorganized way. Or sometimes we start to notice that we have this one stimulus. We hear one word, think something, and suddenly our minds are just racing off in a whole train of thought. You know, so much of our practice is learning to step back and just observe this thought process without becoming lost in it, observing it without becoming adding more to it. What's happening here is we're starting to become disenchanted with thought. This is a word that if you read some of the early teachings of the Buddha, some of the suttas, this word disenchantment pops up here and there. I really like this word, disenchantment, because it suggests that we're waking up from a spell. We're waking up from something we've been confused by, lost by, you know, really overcome by a sorcerer's spell that's shaping how we actually see the world. So the disenchantment is like the waking up from the spell of thought. So then thoughts start to be held much more lightly. Much more lightly, especially those kind of random thoughts. You're just going this way and that way. Again, such a fundamental shift. But especially this is often a point of, I guess I would say, is kind of the, in some ways, it's a test of someone's sincerity with their practice. is how deeply they take this perspective of seeing thought just as thought. What I'm trying to say in a kind of an awkward way is that eventually we have to see even the thoughts we really take, really cherish, the thoughts we really hold as true, as we, you know, we have this strong opinions about it and ideas about it. We start to relate to those just as thinking. We start to say, okay, this whole spectrum is thought. Some thoughts, you know, obviously are very skillful, very helpful. I mean, each one of us uses skillful thoughts throughout our day to do our work, to navigate life. So I'm not, you know, discounting all that. But it's more those really strong opinions that we hold, to start to see those also as thought in itself. I think what I mean by the sincerity of our practice is that we often have these holdouts that, okay, I can let, you know, thoughts of greed and hatred go and all those kind of thoughts. But don't get around this one thought that I know I'm right about it, and all these other people are wrong. Okay, so right there, we've created that quality of separation. Right? So again, the sense of relative reality versus absolute, it gets confusing in there. You know, like, of course, there's some things which are more skillful. There are some thought processes which are less skillful. And yet, from the absolute standpoint, all thoughts are really held equally. You know, thoughts of a very mundane, you know, lost in sense pleasure, lost in greed and hatred, all those charged thoughts are the same as thoughts of the sublime. You know, in a very, again, they were going very, just the very essence, like whether you're thinking or not thinking, if you're lost in thought, identify with thought, or observing thought, that basic line. So it asks us to step away from the content for the time being, the content of the thought, to see how thought interjects a quality of separation with the moment, a quality of distance. So just like with our bodies and how we go through that, okay, I'm fading here, I don't know where I am. If you start to really take this on and start to let some of those most cherished views and opinions also fade, who are you without those opinions? I mean, seriously, what are you if you're not holding those opinions, those ideas? That's why I think it's, I hold it often as a kind of an indication of someone's sincerity, because often we want to stay in those opinions. And that's, you know, we all have our own timing of how the practice unfolds. You know, it's not something to force. All this discussion around boundaries, it's not something to force to make yourself go some way or another, but more to just bring more attention to it, to start to notice, oh yeah, there is separation here. There's distance. And maybe that feels like that's what's needed right here, whether it's in the thought or the body. And other times, when that falls away, when the sense of the body idea relaxes and there's just the felt sense of the body, or if you're able to set aside your opinion enough to really listen to another person, to really open your eyes and, more importantly, your heart, and you see that sense of separation, you sense that separation is faded. There's a sense of connection that's somehow transcending all those ideas and thoughts. Just to notice. And the same thing with emotions. You know, emotions are even a more charged way for some people. I think some people may be more oriented to their minds, to thoughts. Other people more to their emotions, what they really are feeling, they're angry about, sad about, excited about. As you start to relate to even those charged emotions as just another phenomenon that's moving through us, again, we become less defined. We become less identified. And this movement from the contraction, separation, to the release of that separation. In relationships, of course, it's that constant play of, you know, how much do I need to protect myself and have those boundaries or have that sense of mutual respect? And when does that start to become a barrier to keep myself separate, to keep myself a little isolated, to keep myself a little hidden, sheltered, you know, versus releasing that sense of protection? This is, again, always this play of discernment, of wisdom, of learning when there needs to be more firm boundaries, when there needs to be that, you know, drawing that line and protecting yourself when things don't feel so skillful from the other person or for yourself, to say, okay, I'm gonna stop talking right now and let myself cool off, talk to a friend to kind of get perspective. These are all very skillful. And there's also that quality of deep intimacy, that deep quality of undefendedness that sometimes if you can relax into if the other person is willing to meet you there. So all this talk is really moving how the spiritual practice moves more and more that quality of non-separation. To use the famous words of Dogen, who I've shared many times, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body, as well as the mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains. And this no trace continues endlessly. And the release of separation, the release of boundaries. And then this practice, it doesn't just stop with non-separation. It starts to come back into the importance of reforming, of reestablishing. This is this paradox that we go from form to formless and then back to form. And this is really the importance of learning how to find the place within both of those. But hopefully as we come back into form, there's this deeper perspective of non-separation within that form. So it's an interesting quality that form can't imagine or hold the formless. You know, separation can't understand non-separation. That's just built in, baked into that perspective. Well, by non-separation, unity, the formless, emptiness, stillness, so many words to describe it, that obviously it deeply knows it holds form. It holds those details. It holds separation itself. So we start to develop this fluidity of going back and forth between form and formless. Next year, Turi and I are going to explore the ox herding pictures. You know, there was old timers, Rodney did this a number of years ago. But it's a beautiful example, you know, map of the spiritual practice. And there is this going into form to formless, and then back into form. And yet that form is transformed. It's very different from the pre-form, the perspective. The same thing with boundaries. Boundaries start to be able to, you just draw them naturally. There's this deep understanding of your own integrity, your own sense of wholeness, and really importantly, the other person's wholeness, those other person's integrity. So it's really deeply in there, understanding what that is and what that feels like. And there's the release of that of that boundary of separation. And when boundaries are needed, and when someone is perhaps down or hurt or has a quality of being, you know, just not more vulnerable, let's say, you know, the boundaries just naturally arise to support them. When you find that you yourself are more vulnerable, to take the time to keep those boundaries there. And it moves, it doesn't have the same kind of charge that we often do until we really learn this. And I was reflecting that Thanksgiving is in a couple of days, and the homework is, as Ken shared and you picked up online here, or picked up in person and he shared online. As we go around loved ones, we often do really encounter our boundaries. We encounter our relationship to boundaries, especially if we're around siblings or our parents or our children. You know, we say, oh, wow, I can't say no, or I'm always kind of, you know, enmeshed in this other person. And so bringing that into our practice, and I'll speak about that in a moment here. To start to make it a time of practice of how can I bring this understanding of boundaries into this? All right, I'm just going to finish with a little poem. And then we'll talk about the homework and see if there's any questions or comments out there. This Only by Czesław Milos. This Only, a valley and above it forest and autumn colors. A voyager arrives, a map leads him there, or perhaps memory. Once long ago in the sun, when snow first fell, riding this way, he felt joy strong without reason. Joy of the eyes. Everything was the rhythm of shifting trees, of a bird in flight, of a train on the viaduct, a feast in motion. He returns years later, has no demands. He wants only one most precious thing, to see purely and simply, without name, without exception, expectations, fears, or hopes. At the edge of where there is no I or not I. This Only. All right, if you could just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle. All right, so in a minute or two, we'll have a chance for any questions or sharing around this inquiry, or also other things in your practice are welcome. But just to unpack the homework a little bit. So I know with COVID, it's unusual still, but we may find ourselves with family or with loved ones. And notice our relationship in that. Just notice our relationship to boundaries as we're interacting. So just pointing out to step back a little bit and notice that quality of, you know, where is that sense of boundaries? How am I showing up? How are they showing up? And especially our family dynamics often formed around the presence or absence of boundaries. And if you're, you know, if you're not with your family or with loved ones or, you know, your partner, to also notice that presence or absence of boundaries. Just around simple things like who does the dishes, you know, who helps prepare food, you know, who does this or that. how does that all shake up? So just step back a little bit and notice that whole dynamic. And see if you can start to discover an internal alignment with your boundaries and integrity so you can gracefully and skillfully define healthy boundaries. Okay, so this is actually asking a lot of us, but to just kind of set that intention to see, okay, can I just have connection with that? You know, a nice tip is if you really take this on, you may find yourself a little buffeted by the lack of boundaries or over obtrusive boundaries in your family. To take a little break, take a little walk outside or something, just to get a little breather and get some perspective. You know, if you're lucky enough to have a spouse or a loved one or a partner that you can kind of debrief, even just connecting with nature for a few moments and just see, okay, what would it feel like if I had that quality of integrity, that sense of what's a wholeness in relationship to myself and another person, and see how the actions may shape around that. And then finally, start to see, is there a way to have boundaries without the personal charge behind them? This is going that trajectory, that movement we talked about explored in the talk, going from that personal charge. Okay, I have to really assert my bond. You have to, you know, claim it. And I feel really nervous about that. I don't feel like I deserve it. There's all this pushback. There's all that. Again, not judging what's coming up, just to notice it. But then see if there's a way, can I say a boundary without having that such a personal charge? Or if I can't, you know, what would shift, would have to shift around that? And this is going to point back to the whole topic of the talk around that dissolving of our sense of separation. This is going to highlight where we are really fixed, identified. So if it's helpful, play with that a little bit. All right, so let's open to see any questions or sharing there might be. People have permission to unmute, Cheryl. All right, so if you'd like to share something or ask something, you can, probably best if you raised your virtual hand, you can do that by going someplace on your Zoom. Or if anyone here in person would like to share anything. It's Carlito, come on up. So I'm going to shift this so you can see him.
Just a quick question. I was wondering what your definition of integrity is. I was thinking it's essentially the set of your core values is equivalent to one's integrity, or I was wondering if you had a different take on that.
Sure. So the question is around integrity and what I mean by that. Well, I'm using it actually in a more simple way, just like if you had I don't know if this makes sense, but like if you had a structure and it was in integrity, it was like it's all fully formed. There's no weak spots. There's no parts which are underdeveloped. It's just there's a sense of integrity with that. It's almost like if you were, if you put like, okay, well, sometimes I get a rush of different analogies, which I have to kind of see which ones are actually helpful. But if you had I'll go back to my martial art days. So sometimes someone might put their hand out and you make contact with their wrist or something. And sometimes you could feel that when I did that, that would go into their shoulder. They would get kind of pushed around by that. Other times, you would take a hold of them and you feel this direct line through all their skeletal system will line them right up to the ground. So essentially, it felt like you were pressing against the ground. So there's that sense of integrity, things being lined up, a sense of support around it. So I think you can look at integrity around your ideals and values as a form of that. But I was thinking much more basic, just like the body, the sense of the emotional health, the sense of mental health, that there's a sense of okay, this is well established. This feels connected. It feels like there's no divots or holes in this process. I can stand on my own 2 feet. It's, you know, so certainly ideally our deepest values come, you know, that helps us land on that. But so like if I'm talking to someone, I guess I'm very somatic based. So that's maybe some of the analogies may be a little not fit for everyone. But if I'm talking to someone, I'm feeling like I'm intimidated by them or I'm feeling nervous about something or I'm upset by something. My sense of internal integrity is not so there. I can actually feel my body like I'm, you know, distorting myself. It may be very subtle. It may be more energetic than anything else. But if I'm feeling, okay, I can really be here, there's like a sense of clarity of the lines of structure.
So it's almost more of a embodied sense.
Yes, that's a short way of saying, I was trying to say.
Right.
It's in a more embodied way. And that's just how I'm articulating it. That's how I'm sensing it. And, you know, the kind of the values that may be a very important part of it.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Carlito. All right, let's come back to online. So we got a... Okay, so Ken put a helpful chat instructions about it. There's different formats of Zoom, so I get a little confused. So anyone online like to share anything? All quiet online. All right. Anybody back in the room like to share anything? Yes, come on.
I'm finding myself thinking about Thanksgiving preparation. And what I notice is how complicated my thoughts can get about the motivation of the other person. And that really never helps. And I really liked what you said, Tim, about the more I can stay embodied in, like, this is feeling a little intrusive. I don't need to make them right or wrong. I'm just noticing right now, this is a yes for me or this is a no for me. And I don't feel quite so rigid about it.
Yes.
And then I'm also not stuck in it of like, and they better not do it again. It's more like, okay, and that's over. And then what happens next?
Yes.
Which would feel very much more gentle than my habitual, like, battle, shall we say.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. So I think that you started off by saying there's so many thoughts about trying to interpret someone else's. And I think that's, you know, again, that's a common thing that I think we're trying to interpret what the other person is thinking, what they're feeling, what they're going to like and not like. And often we're very wrong about it. We're just kind of, you know, we're trying to fill the void in there. But you can see if you kind of picture where your boundaries are, you're not very back to that. You're not so integrated. You're not so, it's like you're kind of like you have these feelers. You're trying to see, okay, what's going on here? And, you know, there's a lot of wanting to know to make things go smoother or to, you know, they help navigate all the interpersonal dynamics. But yeah, see if you can kind of reel all that in and just say, yeah, like that's a yes or that's a no, or ask them a straight question like, well, would you mind doing the dishes or would you mind, you know, bringing this dish or whatever it might be? So it can be a really rich area of practice. That's why, again, I like just the simplicity of, okay, am I balanced with myself or am I shifted out? And a good cue is when the mind starts to proliferate. You know, you're probably not very in yourself when you're doing that, especially if you're really trying to figure out someone else. So it's, yeah, good to say, okay, what's the basic thing I'm feeling? I'm feeling anxious that they're not going to like not be happy or not going to be upset. And just, you know, acknowledge that. And then maybe ask, is there anything that we could do differently? Or, you know, just kind of lay right out there. And of course, they're going to have their own way of doing it because they're used to you doing this. So it's going to be an interesting readjustment.
And not to imply that my Thanksgiving, I anticipate it being a battle because there'll be lovely things too.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Thanksgiving, especially if you're the host, and fortunately in this kind of the society, we women tend to, really take that on. They really do a lot of it. The mothers, my in-laws, it's like, and you, it's just this whole mechanism kind of gets going, and it's very stressful for them especially. But there's also, if you step back and look at how the boundaries are working, it's or lack of those. We're bringing a little bit of consciousness to a pattern that may be there for 50 or 60 or 70 years. So, be realistic, like we're not going to suddenly transform. But yet, things might shift. All right. Thank you, Kaba. All right. Anyone online have anything to share? All right. We'll see if there's anyone here in person. Anyone else have anything to share? Anything confusing? I can't. It's always hard to tell as a teacher, like, did I just like be completely confusing, or is it not land, or is it just so clear that there's like no questions going on? Yes, Steve, go ahead.
Well, for me, there's a couple things that prevented me from saying anything because I have to make myself vulnerable. I had a interaction where I was making myself more important. I was clinging to my sense of self. I was focused on was thinking that because something is important to me, it is not important to you or to this other person I was speaking to. I don't want to say who. That meant what was important to me wasn't important to this person that I really cared about. So I'm fitting this into the discussion of boundaries and your homework. Can there be boundaries without personal charge behind it? Because that created a personal charge, that disappointment, I guess, or wanting something from this other person, a validation or something. So I'm thinking about this now in the context of your homework and then of this imaginary internal model of what I am and deserve and want and what I'm attached to versus how I can align what you said. What was it you said? How I can align my boundaries with my intention to not cause upset, to not cause harm, to decrease harm. That's all.
All right, thank you, Stephen. Yeah, it's so helpful to you recognize that wanting to be, validated, like you're what's really important for you. You want that other person to agree with you. And, there's nothing more validating when we're sharing something that's so dear to us. Another person's like right there with us and also finding it really important for them. And, you know, it's very, again, it's very human to see that wanting, that sense of validation. So I think it's always helpful in our practice to not set up like ideals, like we should be this way. If I was more put together as a spiritual practitioner, I would never have that come up. I would be able to just hold that ideal of non-harm and draw, you know. And so that kind of course sets up a, you know, it tends to obscure the parts of us which aren't fully, you know, evolved or fully woken up around that. And I think it's much more helpful to really lead with a lot of compassion, to say, wow, you know, I want to be validated. I want to be accepted. I want this other person to really get how important this is and how important, you know, this should be for them too. And just to feel that, see that whole mechanism, to step back and observe that. And including, you know, the shift of that, okay, here I am in my own space, my own sense of integrity, and how that I lose that when I'm really wanting the other person to approve of me or validate me. And again, not to judge that, because judgment just, it's like it hardens the whole process. Just notice, oh wow, I'm really shifting off there. And then you start to, the more you can do that, the more you can in the moment see those things arise. Because if you think you're going to get to the point where that stuff just doesn't arise, it's going to be a long way. I mean, things do transform. Things do fall away in surprising ways. But more what happens is you just start to be able to catch it and observe it much more quickly. So it's not unconscious. So it's not coming in this way. It kind of comes sideways or distorts the conversation without you being conscious of it. So, you know, you're communicating, you're talking, and you're also noticing, oh, that's coming up. And then there's a choice. Like, do I articulate it or do I just make a shift? Or maybe I say, well, this is just dear in my heart. And how about you? What's dear to your heart? What are you passionate about? And then suddenly, you know, then there's a dialogue and it's a back and forth. So it's this really interesting, you know, the more in some ways empty we can be inside of our own opinions, the more we can dance with the personal nature of relationships. All right, so that's what comes to mind, Stephen. Hopefully that's...
what I hear is interaction. Continuing the dialogue, whatever, engagement.
Yes, yeah, that back and forth, that sense of really feedback. There's the feedback, there's the communication, and then really there's that... That's where, you know, when we both have clear boundaries and there's this beautiful meeting of that, really, you know, through my own sense of integrity and wholeness, I can meet another person's wholeness and integrity. And then, you know, we know there's this little tender spot, or there's this little spot here that's a little weaker, and we just naturally respect that and we meet each other and go back and forth with that. And this, you know, doesn't matter if we're talking about something, you know, academic, something spiritual, something interpersonal. All right, thank you, Stephen. All right. Anyone back here in person? Yeah, Deb. My in-person people are coming through tonight.
So Kubba was talking about Thanksgiving. You mentioned Thanksgiving. So Thanksgiving is a time when I think about family connections and I think about relationships with siblings. So this is, you know, for so many of us and myself included, so it's the third rail, you know, the sibling thing. And it was so funny the other day, my sister now lives in the Seattle area and, she moved here a couple of years ago, which means that really for a lot of my life, I lived far away from her, which was not altogether a bad thing. But now that she's here, then I have all these occasions to notice, how alike we are in some ways, which I never really wanted to see, you know. I really preferred to be quite different from her. And a friend of ours was over at the house the other day, and he commented that my voice over the telephone is very similar to my sister's voice on the telephone. And I was aghast about this. I said, oh my God, you know, genetics has ruled the day here. You know, how can this be? So I don't know why I'm saying this, I guess, but I know that I'm going to be spending a lot of time with her over Thanksgiving. And there's just times when it's just darn uncomfortable to see that we look the same in certain ways. You know, we have the same parents, so there's this gene pool we draw from. Then my voice is the same as hers. And I just want to scream running from the room sometimes. So the boundaries get very blurry then, and very uncomfortable sometimes. I love my sister, but, you know, but. So it's just an interesting thing to practice with. And say, well, I know that we're related, but couldn't we just figure this out? I don't know, be a little more separate sometimes, although we are separate. It's a very confusing thing, the sibling thing. Yeah, so I don't really know what I'm saying, but thanks. But I just think about it a lot, maybe because she lives here now in the area, and I have to just notice this. When she was 3,000 miles away, I just could ignore it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I sort of like that better in a lot of ways.
All right, thank you, Deb.
Yeah.
All right, let me see if I can respond to that a little bit. Make sure I'm unmuted. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, the confusion around it, the sense of just not quite sure what, you know, what all this stuff is going on, and the sense of wanting to be more comfortable with her 3,000 miles away. I mean, that's what you're describing. You're really sensing that edge of, to use the Buddhist term, that ignorance, that delusion, that quality of what's not so seen. Is really kind of being confronted by, you know, your sister's presence and how she is similar to you, all those things that come up. It's like that uncomfortableness is like showing, okay, there's something here that's not really fully seen. And, you know, it makes so much sense as a sibling, because you have such a long-standing relationship with her, a long-standing history with her around it. And so I often find when there's a lot of charge like that, the first thing is to try to find a place of, okay, where's my ground? Where can I connect with the earth? Where can I feel myself more centered? Because when you're kind of lost in the confusion and the reactivity and the self-judgment and the judgment of her, that I want to run screaming from the room energy, you know, it's your system's overloaded. You know, going back to boundaries, it's like your system, it can't handle that anymore. It's like you're getting... It's beyond its tolerance. That's another way to talk about integrity. Is like with this, like a structural thing. Once it gets too much weight on it, it's going to snap. You know, and so where's that place where the weight, you can hold the weight well? Okay, so when you feel that sense of wanting to scream, run screaming from the room, you know, seeing if you can find, you know, a little bit of space, a little bit of either might be physical space, like go for a walk, or, you know, maybe go to the bathroom for a little extra long time or something like that. And just take some time, you know, okay, I'm just going to breathe. I'm just going to really connect with this body. And then just come back and see, okay, the basic question is, what are you adding to this moment? What is being added to it? And it's hard with your sibling. And I think, you know, your question, many of us can relate to that, whether it's siblings or parents or children, is like what we're adding to the moment is like we're suddenly, we have like under 10 feet of baggage we've just added to the moment, and we can't have any perspective. So you get enough and a little bit of cooling it down, a little bit of grounding, and just see if you can find one thing that's a little bit more, what's real prominent, you know, in terms of investigation or learning about it. And here's a shortcut. It's just to simply notice what's your habitual response around your sister? You know, running, screaming from the room. Okay, what would be opposite of that? And practice that a little bit. So maybe it's saying, oh, hello, let me talk to you who has the same voice as me and looks the same and reminds me of all the stuff. Yes, sit down. And a little bit of that turning toward, that sense of being a little more curious, you know, for a short period, and then get up and use the bathroom or, you know, go do something in the yard or something. Yeah, so it's charged stuff. It's definitely very charged stuff. And, you know, the charge means there's a lot of potential growth and healing from it. It's just whether we can hold that charge in a way that makes it workable and learning to kind of titrate it, you know, find it so we can actually practice with it. Yeah, so thank you for sharing that, Deb. All right, I see Iris. Go ahead.
Hi, Tim. Oh my goodness, I'm having a block all of a sudden. But okay, here I remember. First of all, I wanted to hold up our end on the Zoom end, you know, because we were disappointing you a bit. So, my boundaries are kind of really back and forth. I have sort of thought of myself in recent years as kind of a passive aggressive kind of person, you know, and I can get like really insecure and unsure of myself and, you know, needing approval and wanting to be liked and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and then moving to the, you know, and then like rebounding to being opinionated and blah, blah, blah. And so when I see all of that now arise, like when I'm in meetings and I'm on a lot of Zoom meetings these days, I'm just able to watch it a little bit more with kind of just more softness and sort of seeing like, yeah, this is what this personality does, and not getting as attached to it or not taking it as seriously. And somebody in a talk the other day used the acronym, it was actually Joseph Goldstein. And I don't know if it was his or somebody else's, but it was WAIT, which is why am I talking? And so, you know, to kind of be quiet more and listen and just, when I have strong reactions to what somebody else is saying, just try my best to be quiet and let it pass. And if something needs to be done at some point, it can be done. But when I react strongly, I would like to try and be quiet more. Thank you.
Thank you, Iris. I think Sylvia Bordstein first came up with WAIT. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure. But yeah, that's such a nice acronym. Why am I talking? And I think to highlight too, one of the things you said is that you find yourself taking yourself less personally. I think that's such an important element of this whole practice. That's what it feels like to become less identified. That you also said that this is just what this personality does. Remember, I think it was Nisargadatta talked to one of those non-dual teachers from India, was speaking of how the personality, you know, we sometimes have this idea that if we became fully awakened, our personality would just, you know, vanish. And his words were more, your personality is like, that's trying to get rid of your shadow. It follows you around, you know, wherever you go. It's like Peter Pan, you know, I guess he lost his shadow. But anyway, his shadow is attached. And so having that sense of starting to really acknowledge, okay, this is just my makeup. This is my genetics, my nurturing, my family dynamics that shaped how this mind is, how this heart is. And the trick is just to take it less and less personally. It's like, oh, wow, this is what the mind's doing. It's doing the passive aggressive part. It's doing the opinionated part. It's like, oh, that's just what the mind does. And if you use that sense of waiting, why am I talking? To pause and say, okay, what am I taking personally? Where am I invested? That's kind of the Dharma route, is to see, where am I taking my stance as I, me, and mine? That's such a critical piece there. And then at the same time, starting to have a lightness, a quality of humor when you do, oh, just, I really want to say this. And that's just my mind doing its thing. So thank you, Iris.
Thank you, Tim.
All right. Anyone else before we close? Yes, go ahead.
I was just hearing about families, and I think what Steve was talking about, I'm not saying it was family, but just in terms of boundaries. And my sons, I have a son who's in his upper 20s, who's here, lives here and works here, and a son who's in college. And I've worked really hard to, over the years, raising them to, not talk about one with the other. And when they brought something up, have them work it out themselves and the whole bit. And I've felt really good about that. But since they've been living in different cities, when they get back together, they independently come to me about the other. And, you know, I set up these rules and now they're not following them. Mm-hmm. And I'm still following the rules, but the fact that my silence or my unwillingness to intervene is seen as, you don't care, or you've given up on us, or you've raised us and you're letting us go. And if I say something, or make it, God forbid, suggest, then I'm meddling. And so I was, as listening to everyone, thinking about how things are starting. I mean, they're watching football right now at the house, and there's no telling what I'm going to be hearing when I get home tonight. But I've decided, just, I was thinking about Pema, about the things falling apart, and just letting it be a disaster, just letting it be whatever it is. Because I can't fix it. I can't do anything about it. And trying to maybe incline the mind toward faith that that it will work its way out somehow without me having to fix it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm a call-in radio show, like your Delilah. Like, what song would you play to that? But thank you.
Delilah's been around a long time, man. Yeah. But I don't have any songs for you, so.
Between a rock and a hard place.
Well, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, or you know, if I go, there will be trouble. If I stay, there will be double. But there is that, you can sense the boundary dilemma right there. Is like, you have this sense of integrity. Okay, I'm not going to speak about one to the other, and have that sense of holding that, and then, but they're not following that process, and so you can feel, and you can feel the pull. You can see, one wants you to do it, and one, you'd be upset if you did it, and you can see right there where it is. So, especially as a parent, you have to. That's such a big lesson, is to let the kids learn their own lessons. And, but doesn't mean you can't stay within your integrity fully. You can listen to one, complain about the other. You could reflect, sounds like that sounds really hard. Sounds like, so you can really affirm what their experience is and say, can even be, articulate, say up front, my basic rule is not to talk, to try to intervene between you two. you know, you two have to work that out yourselves, because I have to care for both of you equally. I have to love both of you equally. And, you know, you can offer suggestions, like maybe you guys, they could do sibling therapy. I mean, sometimes that's really helpful. Maybe you can coach them how to talk to each other, but it's, you know, really honoring your own integrity becomes a great lesson as a parent for your adult children. So I mean, it sounds like you're working with it well, but it's challenging. Yeah, so keep to that own sense of integrity. Thank you for sharing that. All right, so we've come to the end of our time together. So next week on Monday, we're switching topics to the four worldly winds, or the eight worldly winds. Yeah, the eight worldly winds. So it should be an interesting way to end out this year of exploration of Dharma in daily life. So you're welcome to say goodbye, and thank you all for your participation.